are listening to a recording of Los Altos Institute's course, Wokeness as Religion. My name is Stuart Parker, and I am the instructor. Today, I want to begin talking about Canada's special susceptibility to wokeness. People have made some observations about countries that have proceeded both with normalizing various aspects of wokeness, enforcing some of them through legislation. And certainly Canada has been on the cutting edge of that. We, on a number of fronts. But in some of the countries where that has happened, there has been very substantial social movement pushback. In England, in Scotland, in Spain, even though legislators moved quickly and in a pretty coercive way on some of these issues around diversity, the DEI training, the gender orthodoxy, all that kind of stuff. Canada is striking because the state moved very rapidly, as did many of the legacy institutions in our society, as did the media in adopting these things. But we didn't see any really significant pushback here. We see a largely compliant, not supportive, but compliant population. The closest we can really come to finding cases like this elsewhere in the world are Australia and New Zealand, which should tell us something quite interesting, right? Because if we were to pick countries in the world with which we have the most in common historically, it would be Australia and New Zealand. So some commonalities. Obviously, former British colonies that that formed into white settler state nations in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Those would be features of all three countries. Australia and Canada, in fact, of all of the countries that participated in the immigration boom, this period when millions of Europeans migrated to the New World, between the 1870s and 1920s, tens of millions. Canada and Australia enthusiastically recruited immigrants, as did Brazil, Argentina, South Africa, the United States, the other white settler states of the world. However, Australia and Canada had the most restrictive rules for which immigrants were acceptable, whereas Brazil had the least. Canada and Australia were willing to sacrifice economic development to ensure that we had the whitest immigrants possible. Another common feature of these countries is that their original history is about a very gradual process of independence from the British Crown. With all of these countries, right, we see the creation of our dominion in the late 19th century as the first act of independence, and that those acts of independence really continue up until the 1980s. When we've achieved full independence. A noteworthy feature of these countries is that we tend to have been settled much more by Scots, Ulstermen, The Welsh than the United States. The United States, after its revolution, after the American Revolution, the British had an in-depth look at why America had risen up. And what they found was that most of the revolutionaries did not, in fact, believe in liberalism, nor did they believe in having a republic. They believed that it was the right of every Englishman under the English common law to rise up and slay the king's evil counselors. Like every other significant revolution in human history, the American Revolution was hijacked during a consolidation of power at the end of the revolution. The liberals largely imposed a set of ideas on a population that had no idea it had risen up in favor of those things. There's a lot less daylight between figures like Lenin and George Washington than we might imagine. So we want to recognize that the English colonies that were colonized after that, the English were very deliberate. They put people from other conquered peoples in charge of their next round of colonies. So whereas a lot of the original loyalists who came to Canada were Englishmen who didn't recognize those common law rights or didn't believe in them or didn't believe that King George's government was unjust, the people who were actually sent by the empire to run Canada were overwhelmingly Scots. And that's why before we started appropriating Indigenous rituals for our civic festivals and ceremonies, our rituals were not English. They were overwhelmingly Scottish, right? It was normal for the Governor General to show up in a kilt. That was part of the understanding that this was a Scottish-made nation. And the English were right. There was no way to frame some revolutionary rights in terms of our Englishness. Our rulers were somebody else's stooges. And that I think strongly imprinted on the three successful Anglo colonies. It's noteworthy that it's the descendants of loyalists, not the descendants of the Scottish ruling class who were behind the 1837 attempted revolution in Canada. So we have a peculiar social contract in a number of ways, and there are a whole bunch of ways that this social contract has set us up for accepting wokeness. A thing that makes Canada different from these other places is, of course, the large pre-existing French population. And Quebec, if we're to look at its political trajectory, the English initially think about Protestantizing Quebec. And that's their original plan with the place before they realize that that is going to take quite a while and is not going to be easy and is going to end up pulling into Protestant churches people who might be a disruptive influence there. Canada's already the British Empire essentially enters into a partnership with the Roman Catholic Church to govern Quebec. And beginning at the start of the 19th century, we can characterize the politics of Quebec between, let's say, 1815 and 1965 as a conflict between conservative Catholics and Jansenist Catholics. And that's something that's happening all over Latin America. Quebec, if you remember that it's just a part of Latin America that got loose, you know, if you want to understand Quebec, you know, it's better to look at a place like Argentina than to look at an adjacent jurisdiction in English Canada. you know, I think Montreal seems like a perfectly normal Argentine city, just with better public transit. So in Quebec, there are essentially two polarities, two main political polarities. There are the Jansenists, who are liberals, who believe in a theory of liberalism that's different than American liberalism. It's called Napoleonic or Jansenist liberalism. And that's the group that wants this quasi-theocracy to end. On the other hand, you have conservative Catholics who feel that that Quebec's close relationship with the Catholic Church makes it a better, more orderly place. And that's essentially the political fight that went on in Quebec until the successful conclusion of the Quiet Revolution in 65. Or maybe 76 or maybe 82. But the Parti Bleu was conservative. Parti Rouge was Napoleonic liberal. That evolved into the liberals versus the conservatives, who then fully elaborated their system when the Union Nationale was created by Maurice Duplessis in the 1920s. Quebec was largely a rural place. It had low rates of literacy. Most of the provincial and federal ridings in Quebec were in rural Quebec, and were the outcomes of the election there were largely controlled by the Catholic Church. What that means is that the people that we might see as anti-authoritarian, in favor of human rights, politically progressive, this was the liberal faction of Quebec. Even when the Liberal Party took power, it really lacked the sort of hegemonic social control to reform rural Quebec or to push the church down off its perch. Quebec did not have a ministry of education until 1960. The church's wholly controlled education until 1960. Including places like Brebeuf College, which was Jansenist, but was still wholly controlled just by a different faction of the Roman Catholic Church. And it's through places like Brebeuf that people like René Lévesque and Pierre Trudeau came up. So a few words about the Jansenists before we get back to the Anglos. Like other people who believe in Napoleonic, Jansenist, or I'll give another word for it, Bolivarian liberalism, the theory of liberalism that Simon Bolivar believed in, that motivated the Latin American independence wars of the early 19th century, the Jansenists were, this type of liberal was profoundly distrustful of democracy. Profoundly distrustful of any sort of large collective organization in society, be that the church, be that a political party, any of those things. The Bolivarians largely believe that when a bunch of people group up, they're going to get up to no good. And that the purpose of liberalism is to preserve the rights of individuals to act independently. Unlike the Jeffersonians, who saw no contradiction between the rights of small collectives and the rights of individuals, Napoleonic liberals are at the opposite end of the scale. They see a 100% contradiction between these things. And much of the work of figuring out liberalism during its 200 years of hegemony has been about figuring out the balance between those things, between the rights of the individual and the rights of the community. The Bolivarians, the Jansenists, they never trusted communities and largely sought to limit, to enhance individual rights through legal means that didn't rely too heavily on democratic forces. Right, and our Constitution was written by such a person. That's the Canadian Constitution is, it accommodates the level of democracy we have, but it has very little to say about democratic governance. It begins with the Declaration of the Supremacy of God, and then it proceeds to lay out in a charter individual rights. Now, Pierre Trudeau had to be talked out of holding a referendum on the Constitution after it was made clear by the province of Saskatchewan that it would only sign on to this document if there were a way for provincial governments to suspend those individual rights in the name of the collective, the notwithstanding clause, as it's called. Jean Chrétien, Marc Lalonde, Trudeau's courtiers had to convince him to accept the notwithstanding clause. To him, that was too great a compromise to make with collective rights and democratic control if they subordinated the rights of individuals. Okay, so Quebec does go through a process called the Quiet Revolution in the 1960s, following the death of Maurice Duplessis and attempts by the Union Nationale to present a kinder, gentler face to Quebec, which was probably a terrible mistake. They had ruled by fear since the beginning, and you can't go from ruling by fear to ruling by love. You can go the other way all the time. All kinds of people start out popular in politics and then begin ruling by fear when their popularity goes away. Doing the switch the opposite way never happens for a reason. There's tremendous built-up anger against you. And once you stop looking threatening, that anger comes pouring out. And it came pouring out in the form of the Quiet Revolution, which radically secularized Quebec and broke the power of the church by seizing control of the hospitals and the schools in the name of the state. The people who prosecuted that revolution were the quiet revolutionaries, we might call them, had been activists, had been free speech activists and anti-corruption activists in the post-war era. Thérèse Cassegrain is probably one of the most important of those people. It's a real shame to see how much she has been taken out of our history. She was the wife of a very popular liberal in Quebec, and she came from money. Like Trudeau and most of the others, these were members of Quebec's upper class who had been being educated at Blaisbeuf College for centuries. It's just that they decided to be serious about their belief in liberalism and profoundly challenge what was going on, because that was the spirit of the times in the 1960s. But other than René Lévesque, none of the major quiet revolutionaries were populists. And other than René Lévesque, almost none of them came from the middle class or the working class. Largely Jean Marchand and Lévesque were pretty much the only ones to come out of that. And Lévesque splits with the Quiet Revolutionaries in 68, in part because they're not willing to become separatists. But there's a larger grievance that we miss, which is that Lévesque leaves because he doesn't think these people trust the people. He doesn't think they trust democracy or believe in democracy. And whereas most of these guys' ideas about democracy were formed in the seminar rooms of Université de Laval or Brébeuf, the political thinking of René Lévesque was formed as a foreign affairs reporter for CBC or for Radio-Canada in Europe in the post-war era. When Lévesque is filing news stories from the new welfare states of Western Europe, where's Pierre Trudeau? Well, he's gone backpacking to celebrate Mao's seizure of power in China. Right? And we have to remember that people, the honor that's given Norman Bethune here, the close relationship, right? What are we talking about in the news today? The close relation, that our special relationship with the Chinese Communist Party goes a way, way back. Trudeau admired Mao's ability to smash the long-term institutions of his society, the ability to govern based on philosophical principles as an autocrat. These were things that struck a chord with Bolivarian or Napoleonic liberalism. So the key elites of Quebec, anti-church, democracy skeptics. Many of them are devoutly religious, as was Pierre Trudeau, made his kids pray every night at dinner. As a parent, he was strict and austere and incredibly devout. And like many of the Jansenist secularizers, like Plutarco Calles of Mexico, like Benito Juarez of Mexico, Trudeau really believed that he was commanded by God to secularize his society. This seems very strange, but you've got to remember that this is understandings like this have been part of Catholicism since Catholicism understood itself to be Catholicism. First of all, one has to remember that the Roman Catholic Church historically has not been a faction in the societies in which it's important. It has been everything in those societies, and it has always sought to create within itself a place for everyone in those societies. You wanted the dissidents inside the tent. You wanted everybody inside the tent. You go to Utah, you see the same thing in the Mormon church, right? It's incredibly important for Mormonism to maintain its hegemony in Utah that there are places for liberal intellectual Mormons in the institutional culture of the church that can be critical of the conservative elements in the church. And a lot of this comes out of, some of this is just a consequence of how you maintain power in a single religion state. But some of it's also supported by Catholic theology. I think one of the most important contributions, Augustine of Hippo, because it's really his thinking that Roman Catholicism is based on, his observation, right, is that the world is a battle between the city of God and the city of man. And even within the church, the city of man dominates the city of God. The church is not the city of God. Because, as Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. So, Quebec, the great liberals of Quebec, who helped to shape the much less philosophically sophisticated, right, there's a disparity. On the one hand, English Canada has all the money, it has all the land, it has all of this stuff, but it is not a culture that educates people to be politically sophisticated. The English Canada can give out a lot of degrees, but most of the key thinkers about the Canadian social contract who have shaped it have come out of this economic backwater of French speakers. So it's Laurier who shapes our immigration policy in the 1890s when we joined the immigration boom. MacDonald really made no effort to recruit immigrants. Laurier went, well, we've got to catch up. And we're going to reframe how we present Canada. And we see it's in the Pearson government, it's the Francophones who really guide and create the new nationalism of the 1960s. So out of Quebec then, we have an elitist intellectual liberal culture and a conservative populist culture that was defeated in 1965, and although it led one more government after 65, Quebec conservatism was a spent force. All of the conflicts within Quebec since then have been within Quebec liberalism among the Jansenists. In switching back to English Canada, as Canada is figuring out who it is, something very significant is going on that I spoke about in another lecture. The feminization of religion and the rise of the caring professions. So these are contemporaneous things. In the Protestant world, there's been a massive decline in male church attendance, massive decline in male church involvement after the mid-19th century, a sense that churches are feminine or feminized space, and the rise of the ecumenical movement and the ladies' auxiliaries. It's interesting that the ladies' auxiliary system has collapsed in almost every religion other than mainline Mormonism. It's collapsed in every Mormon denomination but one as well. But this was all the rage in the 19th century, creating democratically controlled committees within your churches that were run by women and for women. And it's really important to recognize this, because as much as we might see the LDS Church as anti-feminist, why don't you try interrupting a Mormon woman when she's talking? Men can, it's really easy, right? We're built to interrupt women. I happen to be way too good at interrupting people, and the people who largely suffer at the expense of that are women. And that's partly because we have removed all of the spaces in our society where women can learn how to hold court, how to control a room, because when adolescent girls are being socialized around all this stuff, they are in classrooms full of unruly boys who interrupt them and put them down and create all kinds of incentives for them to accept being socially subordinated at that level. But if you permit there to be spaces where women, where men aren't, can't be present, this produces all kinds of positive outcomes. It produces women who are more assertive, who are more capable of defending their ground. It produces more women in math, more women in science. Women's spaces were hugely important. And a lot of the time people see the rise of the caring profession, secularization, popular democracy, women's suffrage, as women getting out from under the thumb of the church. And this is really an incorrect way to look at it. Churches created the spaces that that permitted women to build organizations like the WCTU, that enabled the women's suffrage movement to really go somewhere, because at the grassroots level, it's practices in church that are increasingly understood to be female controlled, right? Church ministers, who women still can't be ministers, but church ministers start understanding themselves as being primarily accountable to the powerful women in the congregation. And more of the church's activities, you know, dealing with hunger, dealing with clothing, deal with housing, it's the ladies' auxiliaries that are producing these things. British Columbia, I mean, it's really interesting because when I was a kid, one of the most powerful organizations in the province was the Social Credit Ladies' Auxiliary. The BC Social Credit Party was one of the last parties in which there was a powerful separate democratic space for women. Other parties had women's caucuses and women's advisory committees, but they didn't really do any of the business of the party in the way that the Ladies' Auxiliary of Social Credit did real business of the party and made or broke people's careers. We did the same thing with youth spaces in parties as well. And I think that has served us just as poorly. The collapse of the significant political power of youth and women's organizations in the 80s is one of the things that's led us to our present day. But back in the late 19th century, we see ecumenical movements are women controlled. Women can be the heads of ecumenical organizations. And a lot of the creation of the United Church of Canada, the most successful ecumenical project on earth, again, was female led, where three churches merged into one church. No other country did that. The United Church of Canada, its creation also made it, it accelerated secularization in a very strange way. We often talk about how English and French Canada don't have harmonious social contracts, but one of the features of this historical moment is that there's a consensus between the religious leadership of English Canada and the liberal faction of Quebec that secularization is an unqualified social good. What's the reason for that? Well, it's because, as I said, there's this complex relationship between the rise of power of women in churches and then the breaking of the power of the churches. So what was it that ladies' auxiliaries were up to? helping the poor, helping the sick, helping the unhoused. What do the caring professions do? They help the poor, they help the sick, they help the unhoused, they help the mentally ill. Now, if you've got a choice between doing that work as a volunteer at church or like doing that work as a qualified and respected professional in your society, the next generation is going to choose the latter. And this isn't just women who do this, it's men. It's people like J.S. Woodsworth. It's people like Tommy Douglas. They go directly from the clergy into electoral politics, or indirectly from the clergy into social work, into electoral politics. And what this does is Canada's Protestant church attendance, like everybody's mainline Protestant church attendance in the 20th century, starts falling and keeps falling at a certain point. In Canada, we see a somewhat different pattern. We see this brief flowering of Protestant church attendance as educated people rush back into the church. And then we see these churches draining of attendance earlier and faster than anywhere else that went through this. And that's because it quickly becomes the consensus of the Tommy Douglas generation of clergy that you can do God's work better as a social worker than as a minister. And this idea doesn't just affect the far left in Canada. It affects the natural governing party of Canada. One of the most important works on the specific and unique aspects of Canadian political history was a book written in the 1960s by a historian named Ramsey Cook, called The Regenerators. It's a work of intellectual history that has been followed up by works of social history that have confirmed what happened on the ground. Ramsey Cook's book looks at the writings of major social reformers from English Canada who propounded a complex secularist social theory using God as the justification, because there is a term for this rise of social science and its sanctification by the church, which was the social gospel. The social gospel was not a significant movement in the United States, nor in Australia or New Zealand, but it was the most popular social movement in early 20th century Canada. And one of the authors of one of these great sort of syntheses of theology and social science was William Lyon Mackenzie King, Canada's longest serving prime minister. And maybe, I'm sure he'll be surpassed in the next 10 years, but still Canada's most successful crossdresser. He ran the place, for a quarter of a century. And Mackenzie King, it wasn't just that in opposition there was J.S. Woodsworth, who was following the same path. Mackenzie King really believed this and propounded these ideas that essentially what had happened was that it was now the caring professions that were Canada's clergy. And this, I believe, is an idea that profoundly imprinted on Canadians in ways that we're now discovering to be detrimental. We maintain, we actually are great Protestants up to the present day. We just stopped going to church because our church leaders told us to. Because going to, you know, because whereas in Quebec, the schools and the churches were violently seized by the liberals and taken away from the clergy, English Canada went the opposite route. We saw our classroom teachers, our social workers, our public health nurses as our clergy. Whereas in the 1960s, the clerical trappings of the hospital workers and the teachers disappeared. All the nuns' habits, all the robes in schools and hospitals disappeared. That didn't have to happen in English Canada, not because we were secular, but because we already saw the uniforms of these people as their clerical vestments. We superficially secularized as a country. But that secularization is only an inch deep. Canadians actually remain the most devout Protestants. And that's one of the reasons that Protestant churches, unless they have a majority of recent immigrants in them, Protestant churches that are full of Anglo and Scottish Canadians, like, you go to church and it's like you are at a DEI training. There's a PowerPoint up and you know, people are eating pinwheel sandwiches and talking about, you know, decolonization. There's always been zero contrast between our venerable social services and our churches. I went to the Unitarian Church in the 80s, which of course epitomized these things. Unitarians had always been eager to sanctify modernity. The early Unitarian movement used to bless factories in Victorian London when they were constructed. Charles Dickens was writing controversial literature about them. The Unitarians were blessing any large technological improvement, sanctifying it. So in the 80s, when I was in Sunday school, I got to see really early versions of decolonization and concerns about a cultural appropriation. That's why I had to carve a turnip for Halloween instead of a pumpkin, because the pumpkin was culturally appropriated. Yeah, you tried carving a turnip for the first time when you're nine. That was not fun. You know, we made tacos, right? We wanted to decolonize Sunday school, except they bought the really small taco shells that are actually a chip. They don't sell them anymore, but it used to be that we didn't just have those flavor triangle nachos. We had tiny little folded over salted taco chips. Anyway, they brought those. It was impossible, of course, to stuff anything into them. But, you know, the God was never mentioned in any sermon at the Unitarian Church when I went. Philip Hewitt was a great orator, and he told excellent moral lessons. And he did have some cool robes. They had this really greasy assistant minister they had to fire, but that's another story. But the Unitarian Church is just a particularly extreme example of this. The Church of Social Science has always been Canada's church. From our very earliest years, before Saskatchewan or Alberta were provinces, we worshipped at the Church of Social Science. And that is one of the key vulnerabilities that we have. It's an ideological vulnerability that we look to the caring professions and social science with a reverence that does not exist elsewhere in the world. And we ask them bigger questions. Now, capitalist countries all over the world ask economists moral questions. It's insane. It's like, what should we do now? Let's ask an economist. Canada, more likely to ask sociologists, anthropologists, social workers, what is the good? What should we do now? Not, how can we get that water system at Kisechuan fixed finally? Like, that's a good question to ask those people. But these larger moral questions, social science is a cul-de-sac morally. Its predictive models feed back on its aspirational models in really problematic ways that regular churches inoculate themselves against to prevent that happening, to prevent you from just blessing whatever's about to happen next. But we have to remember that the religion of progress was the global hegemonic religion at the time Canada underwent its own bizarre process of secularization. And progressive time consciousness is insane. It is simply the sanctification of the novel, the sanctification of the newest thing. It was really interesting when on my Facebook page, a woman showed up to defend Drag Queen Story Hour. And it's like, but this is new. Why do you not support it? And it's like, why are you asking me that question? Like, that's interesting all by itself. The fact that you can say that this is new somehow pronounces on whether it's a good thing, tells us a lot about the particular moment in social theory that was going on when Canada secularized and it became imprinted on our national ideologies. Now, another feature that I queued up several lectures ago that goes hand in hand with this is Canada never had an Andrew Jackson. What that meant was that, we shot fewer Indigenous people, a lot fewer Indigenous people. That would be a thing from not having an Andrew Jackson. That would make you do that. On the downside, however, we didn't have an Andrew Jackson, and that meant that the old graduate degrees, the great professions, law, theology, and medicine, were run by powerful, powerful guilds whose authority had never been attacked. These guilds made Canada a more syndical society than most places. Now, normally, people hear the word syndicalism, they think of labor syndicalism or anarcho-syndicalism. Those things never happen. They're like aspirations of people from another century. We don't even have to worry about those things. Real syndicalism is epitomized in the Canadian social contract. Syndicalism is the idea that a particular group of people, a particular guild with particular training, run certain parts of your society unmediated by the state. The state delegates to them the authority to control certain things that it then takes its hands off of, other than to control that syndical group's monopoly. That's why the Canadian Bar Association is so self-governing. The Medical Association is so self-governing. And what began to appear in Canada's secularization moment was professional associations of nurses, professional associations of teachers, professional associations of social workers. And these, a lot of the rules for dealing with child apprehensions and things like that, they're not directly controlled by the state. They're controlled by the professional bodies that accredit social workers. Canada, this is why Medicare is not what people think it is, right? Tommy Douglas said to Woodrow Lloyd, hey, why don't you bring in this incredibly politically dangerous program I didn't find time to implement during my 17 years as Premier of Saskatchewan, never got around to it. But now that somebody else is going to have to wear this, Woodrow, why don't you implement Medicare? So Woodrow Lloyd tried to bring in a system like the UK's system, where like the UK National Health Service, in which the doctors are government employees. The government owns the hospitals. Medical practices are government offices. Well, they did that. The doctors went on strike and they let a whole bunch of people die. They're like, you don't get to control those things. We control those things. Period. So we nationalized the only thing we could, which was the insurance system. What we had, what Medicare was we left the power of the medical association and the College of Physicians and Surgeons totally untouched. We didn't seize the hospitals. We've gradually seized the hospitals since the 80s, but we owned almost, Medicare didn't involve the government owning any hospitals. Those were still owned by churches or nonprofit societies or private corporations. And the government couldn't even set the fees that its insurance company was paying. The doctors said, these are the fees. And so a bunch of medical insurance people had to go to work for the government, but no doctors went to work directly for the government. And they held on to the most important thing, which is the right to make more doctors. That's one of the most important powers a syndical organization does, because it wants there to be a constant low-level labor shortage to keep its wages high. You might find it interesting to note that the amount of training you get to become a doctor in another country doesn't affect how our medical association determines international medical graduate certification. However, if you want to look at the color of people seeking certification, there's a very clear pattern. That's why it takes decades for people with medical degrees from Uttar Pradesh, which has some of the most competitive, competent medical schools in the world, takes years to get their credentials recognized. However, every white Afrikaner doctor fleeing black majority rule in South Africa was instantly accredited by our international medical graduate system in the 90s. No wait, nothing. The doctors control who gets to be a doctor. And that's one of the powers the NHS took away from the doctors so that they could make enough doctors, so that there wouldn't be all these labor shortages all the time, which would then depress doctors' wages and make the NHS affordable for regular English people. We didn't do that. That's why, while our healthcare administration spending is now obscene and out of control, for years, Canada had we were paying like 40% of every provincial budget was just money given to doctors, with almost no healthcare administration costs. We were very lean on healthcare administration, unlike the US until about a decade ago. So, because there was nothing to administer, because the syndical organizations the doctors ran administered things, private medical offices administered things, church-owned hospitals administered things. With the judiciary, it's the same thing. And what has happened in the woke moment is that all kinds of syndical properties that have long been held by professions have now been politicized. And that's why we get the case of Amy Hamm. And we get the cases of all kinds of other nurses who have also lost their licenses for political speech who we don't know. I went to a People's Party meeting a month ago and was just shocked to discover how many nurses had lost their accreditation over political speech. And the thing is, right, it's not like the government is firing these people. It's so the College of Nurses decertifies their credentials so they can't get a job as a nurse anywhere else. They've been unnursed, undoctored, unlawyered. So these syndical organizations have vast power. Right. That's how it is that the Canadian Bar Association could decide its number one priority over the past 2 years was making sure that not only that convicted serial rapists could be housed in women's prisons, they achieved that victory 2 years ago, but that convicted serial pedophiles could be placed in prison mother baby units. And they succeeded this March. We now have a convicted serial pedophile leering at children, a prison mother baby unit, every day today in British Columbia. And women sleeping in shifts, guarding the children. These syndical organizations, in other words, don't merely have the, it's not just that the Canadian Bar Association controls your eligibility to hold on to your credentials as a lawyer. It doesn't just control the promotion process for people becoming judges. It's so powerful that it can use its power in one place to achieve a political end in another place, like inside the prison system. So Canada has always been hyper-syndical. And the collision of our inch-deep secularism and our syndicalism, you can see what's happened, that the great professions rule in Canada, and Parliament looks after the stuff that they don't want to deal with. And this brings me to the third aspect of Canada's unique vulnerability, something I have spent almost my whole political life warning people about. No one would bloody listen. In 1993, at the start of neoliberalism in Canada, when the Chrétien government was elected, they moved quickly to reform our election laws and create a more robust, more comprehensive election act. Much of our election law was court created rather than legislation created. It came out of long-term traditions that had come over with immigrants from Great Britain. We had a pretty clear sense of how the Westminster democratic process worked. A key feature of this was the institutional power of local party bosses and electoral district level organizations. It was understood until 1993 that in order to field a candidate in an electoral district, the local party members would hold a nomination meeting and democratically select their candidate, and the leader would sign that person's nomination papers and they would become a candidate. Both of those things needed to happen. If one of those parties disagreed with the other, the party would be unable to run a candidate. If the leader didn't sign nomination papers, then the electoral district could nominate a candidate, but they would have to run as an independent, or just they wouldn't run. It's what happened with Robert Stanfield in 74. He found a candidate, I think it was in St. John, New Brunswick. That's usually the hotbed of anti-Francophone activity in Canada. Wouldn't sign their nomination papers. The local riding said, well, screw you. And there was no Tory candidate in that riding. Jean Chrétien created a different framework. He brought in an election act that stated that the leader of the party chose the candidate. Of course, they would do so on the recommendation of local party members. But in 1997, every seat that Chrétien targeted in BC for a pickup, he chose the candidate personally. There was no local democratic process. He immediately used his act in this way. There is another popular thing, a movement I was mistakenly involved in, which was the one member, one vote movement that sought to change how party leadership contests worked. Political conventions were one of the most interesting theatrical aspects of Canadian politics, Canadian political leadership conventions. They were huge, joyous parties in which people would fight with each other and then make up. They were a big part of us reconciling with one another when we had to make tough decisions. Also, it was an endless host bar. So everyone could drink as much as they wanted. And that's why one of the things CTV did when it subversively covered the 1986 Social Credit Leadership Convention was there were only two statistics that went up on every ballot. Bill Van Der Zandt and the number of spoiled ballots. And so they used to do this TV conceit, right, where they'd read out the results of each ballot and then you'd show the candidate and their supporters reacting on live TV to the results. So Van Der Zandt, 834 votes, and there'd be the Zandt waving and be surrounded by his guys. And then, you know, you'd see a more somber image of like Grace McCarthy, 532. CTV, whenever the spoiled ballot statistic was read out, would just show these enormous queues to the industrial Kelowna wines dispensers at the Social Credit Convention, that this was the source of the spoiled ballots, clearly. So these conventions got a reputation for being kind of greasy. And Canadians we have a lot of trouble reconciling with greasiness. Like, it is part of our Protestant culture. It is part of our Jansenist culture, that whereas other countries celebrate greasy aspects of their social contract, Canadians have always been kind of sensitive about that stuff. So we all thought it would be much more orderly and democratic if we removed all the middlemen in choosing our political leaders. Because it used to be these conventions were theater, right? And what would happen is the bottom candidate would be eliminated, and you would see this guy and his guys walk across the convention floor, and not all of the guys would follow the guy. Some would go over here and it'd be really interesting. And that process had already been going before the conventions, because these would have happened at local meetings in all these different towns around the country, where these different local teams would square off against each other and see how many delegates they each won. And then they'd go to the big national convention and hammer this thing out with a lot of mid-level brokers dealing their delegates, you know, that this guy might have been willing to stick with his candidate, but this candidate walked to the wrong person. So now he's going to make a separate deal and go over here and support this person on the next ballot. All that horse trading, all that drunkenness didn't sit well with Canadians. But what about a much cleaner option would be if every member of the party voted directly for the leader in the mail? Well, what that did was it drained all of the power out of the middle layer of people. This is what began the Russification of Canadian politics, where Canadians since the 90s, because of these changes in law and changes in practice, don't have intermediated political relationships. It's like Russia. We choose the autocrat, and the autocrat chooses the people below him. Whereas in the old system, the person at the top was made by all of the different layers of people below him. That's why today, right, leaders used to be dependent on their caucus. That's not true today. The reason you haven't seen a single member of any caucus vote against their leader, although I do see that maniac in Hamilton Center voted against Jagmeet Singh the other day. That was surprising. I mean, honestly, I don't know which of those guys I find more disgusting. So it was kind of a wash for me. But that hasn't happened in like 10 years, that there was like one vote out of place. In fact, today, right, if a leader doesn't just control the vote of every MP, but the words of every MP so that they say exactly the same phrases, well, then this leader's incompetent. They're not really qualified to be the autocrat, are they? We've imbibed this whole Russian theory of politics by changing, but not by embracing Russian culture, but by changing our structure. The structure of a Near Eastern despotism like Russia is the people delegate their power upward to the autocrat, and then the autocrat delegates the power downwards to all the middle people. Why can't MPs defy their leader? Well, it means they can't be renominated. It means this is their last term, because the leader, or rather, the committee of anonymous staffers that doesn't reveal its name, working on behalf of the leader, chooses all the candidates. It doesn't matter if the person's a sitting MP, right? One Liberal MP complained about Trudeau, lost their nomination. Didn't matter that the people in the riding wanted them, or that the party organization quit over it. It was all controlled from the center. So we went through the first law reform in 93. There's a second law reform in 2003, further centralizing power. And it's really after 2003 that whenever a member of the legislature or a member of parliament contradicts the leader, it's reported as a scandal. Not because maybe this person has pointed out a falsehood the leader is saying or an error in the leader's policy. The nature of the scandal is always the same. This leader isn't a competent leader because they cannot control the speech of their followers. That's consistently the media angle from a cultural perspective. It's like, well, maybe this person is collapsing as a leader, not because of their bad policies or bad ideas, but because of the slackening of their control, which should be absolute. is so in the years. So I was recruited by the Tory Riding Association in Vancouver Quadra in 2005 to run in a by-election. I wanted to see what would happen, so I let them refer my nomination up the chain. Maybe it was 07. It was 07, not 05. I mean, the reason they wanted to run me in the by-election against Joyce Murray was the same reason I'm always offered jobs. It's the only reason I'm ever offered a job, unless I give myself the job, which is, we have no idea how to fix this thing. So we thought we'd do something crazy. So we thought we'd call you. It's like, we'd have to do something really weird to win this by-election. Call Parker. So in 07, it went right to Harper's desk. And Harper went, oh, I know who that guy is. No. Which I found very flattering, personally. The fact that the prime minister knew who I was and that he knew that I would just have made trouble. But it's interesting, they didn't get to have a vote about that. In 2010, in order to prevent me running in a provincial by-election, the NDP offered me the federal nomination in that riding, St. Paul's. And by this point, the system I'm talking about had become bureaucratized. Every significant party had what was called a vetting committee that determined the suitability of candidates to run. And those committees did not release their minutes. They did not release the names of their members. We know that most of these vetting committees are made up of lobbyists on furlough. They're just lobbyists on leave, sometimes not even on leave, from their work at Hill and Knowlton or National or one of the other big law government relations firms around the country. I actually suspect that some of these people are on more than one party's vetting committee. But if they're not, they functionally are, because the real decisions are being made in offices at Hill and Knowlton, trickling down to the vetting committee that then uses the leader's authority to veto most of the candidates. Another feature that we've developed is you've got to pay a non-refundable fee to be vetted. So we've also kind of eliminated the working class that way. And people think this is normal and orderly. When I tell people in other countries how our system now works, that there are maybe 25 people in Canada who, between them, choose every candidate for every major party in every riding, people in the rest of the world are shocked. But we began implementing this system, and I started crying bloody murder about it from the very beginning. It's like, this is democracy sunsetting, people, because your choices when you're a voter are meaningless now, right? You're not choosing a local candidate. You've had nothing to do. If you're a member of a party, you've had nothing to do with the candidate being selected. And if you're a regular voter, you know that you're really just determining which of the federal leaders will control your local candidate. The candidate isn't yours. They're a Russian-style representative. If you have a Russian regional governor, his job is as a representative. It is to represent the Kremlin to the region he governs. And that is the job of your MP. It is to represent the view of the party leadership to the people who live in your riding. Now, this took on a cultural aspect. This was originally a legal and procedural thing. But Canadians really did begin believing in this, and begin finding fault with the chaos of genuinely democratic systems like the one across the border in the United States. What's the big Canadian complaint about the American system? Well, one complaint is way too much money. That's fair. The other complaint is that too many people are allowed to choose their party's candidate. These primaries are chaotic. They let people like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump just walk in and win just because millions of people agree with them. Canadians don't seem to think that that's a legitimate reason to win anymore. That's why the Tories haven't even tried to build an opposing coalition to Trudeau's. Trudeau's in minority government. They could hammer out a deal with the other parties and depose Trudeau tomorrow, given that Trudeau got the second largest number of votes twice in a row. The Tories won the popular vote twice in a row. Now, even in the days of Stephen Harper, the Tories would have hammered that and gone, we're the most popular party. We're the biggest team. We should be in charge. Not even trying, because they know it won't sell. Pierre Poilievre knows how to use all of the right slogans to get people who admire Brexit or admire the Trump movement or admire the French yellow vests. He knows all their slogans and he can bust them out. But Poilievre is fundamentally just a representative of the Laurentian elite. That's why he knows his place in this parliament. He's just going to wait for Trudeau to run out of gas. He's not actually even going to try to depose him by seeking the support of the Bloc or the NDP. Now, what I want to suggest here then is that Canada has tended historically to believe that qualified experts, members of syndical organizations, members of the caring professions, social scientists, are the people who should run our country. And that's why we let them have so much of the power that is normally in the hands of the official government. And what's happened is we're now going through this authoritarian moment, and all of these pre-existing authoritarian things about our society, all of our prior already baked in skepticism of democracy is ready for this. And in this, and this is one, this is the one of the reasons I would argue that Canada has globally been a forerunner on wokeness, and why we have put up the least fight. Other places that tried to blast wokeness through, like England and Scotland, sure, they did it at the same time as Canada, they did it as hard as Canada. But the reaction has been powerful. It has already brought down the government of Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland. Whereas in Canada, this is an elaboration of the social contract we built in the late 19th and early 20th century. It has all the ingredients. Give power over important things to the experts and the organizations that anoint those experts. Superficially secularize, but understand that your schools, your hospitals, your clinics, these are your churches and always have been. And to become more avowedly and nakedly skeptical of democracy as a form of rule or a form or a way of figuring things out. Canadians have been getting ready to lie down and take this for a century or more. And That, unfortunately, is our current cultural moment. If we're going to look at social movements that have stood up against that, that's why I consider, to go back to the most controversial theme in these episodes, it's why I think the Freedom Convoy is significant. Because it was never, that region and its culture were never really part of that, right? The history, the political history of the Boreal Forest Belt is the history of Riel's First Rebellion, of the Northwest Rebellion, of the United Farmers of Alberta movement, the Social Credit movement, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation in its democratic phase. There is, I think, a certain Western exceptionalism in this country that comes out of the agricultural and industrial belt that runs from Timmins to Terrace. Were always seen as irrelevant rubes. They weren't drawn into these social contracts, and that's why they could produce things like the Reform Party out of that heartland. We also want to look at the offshoot of Jansenist liberalism in Quebec, where Lévesque went, no, democracy is one of the things we haven't had. We're going to create the most democratic party in the world. And the Parti Québécois, in its heyday, was the most democratic party in the world. Its members had the most control over its policies and over its leadership. It had the highest proportion of party members within a jurisdiction of any Canadian party. There is this third democratic tradition that comes out of rural Quebec that never saw the patricians, the Jansenists, as the people who were going to rescue them. One that comes out of the voyageur tradition and things like that. So I think that there are forces within Canada, but they're seen as invasive forces, right? That was the accusation that the truckers had invaded the capital of their own country. Similarly, right? People are very willing to say, you weird Quebecers, I don't understand you. You should probably just fuck off. You were never really part of this project, right? These separatists, God knows why we have to keep tolerating them. But the separatist movement was infused with a democratic character. And I would not be surprised if in its death throes, the Parti Québécois, now reduced to the fourth party in the legislature, now that the Jansenists have all joined Solidaire, the radical Jansenists, the liberal Jansenists are doing fine in CAQ, but Quebec's venerable parties are about to disappear. The PQ is down to 6 seats. Most of them are rural, anti-authoritarian, anti-establishment seats. I wouldn't be surprised if in its death throes, it figured out its only move would be to stand up against wokeness. That might be the only thing that lets it survive the next election. Because of course, languages with a strongly gendered grammar rebel against wokeness at a much deeper cognitive level than languages that are minimally gendered in their grammar. So anyway, here's my special case of Canada thing and our fake secularization. Questions and comments from people. Yeah, Cheryl.
I'd like to go back to your last point about the convoy. I mean, it's kind of like catnip to me, but for a cat. The thing that started to percolate after listening to a lot of the episodes and looking at your reading that or what you've put out, that the wokes really had a big influence on how the convoy story unfolded and how it ended. And it goes back to right around the time of defund the police movement. And they're running candidates, the local, I think Catherine McKinnon or whatever her name was. There were politicals that had enough sway on council to have a design of a new police chief that they wanted. And they did their recruiting and they hired the Peter Slotsy.
Yep.
And he was the perfect candidate for him. And they thought that was great. But then when he did his police budget, he wanted an increase and they said, no. We want any extra money that you're asking for to be sent into social service programs. And we would design a system that would help the people that have mental issues and cut down on the police having to intervene in these kinds of things. So they basically, this is really a crass thing to say, but in all of it is like Black guy got it because he landed up having to wear what happened with the convoy. He was blamed by the commissioner that if they had been better organized, then they could have handled things before it became an occupation. And he was sold down the river by that council. I mean, I looked at all the minutes that came out and documents that were submitted to the commission. I mean, it is just terrible what they did to him. Well, and his reputation is gone.
Yeah, and what I want to emphasize is that I think the most significant point is that he was chosen because he believed in something he called progressive policing, which was this idea that you not treat protest movements with a heavy hand, that you maximize. And so when he's being hired, they're thinking about Black Lives Matter, they're thinking about Occupy, they're thinking about Shut Down Canada, and they're going, oh, this is great. This guy is gonna handle my people with kid gloves. But it never occurred to them that he actually saw this as a principle for how you treat any protest movement. The fact that he didn't have a double standard was, I think, a crucial element of this. The other factor was that, back to syndical groups, not every syndical group is woke, and within the COPS, there is one of the most significant pushbacks. Now, some regions, the COPS are woke. I live in one. But it's not true nationally of the RCMP, and it's not true of every force. And so the other thing that began to happen, one of the things that limited what he could do, was, you see, if a bunch of the journalists are, of course, a syndical group, they don't have the kind of ability to regulate their profession. Like, they try to function as a syndical group. The ones that operate like that get federal state patronage, and the ones that do citizen journalism don't. But journalists, as a group, are, of course, quite sympathetic to woke protest movements. COPS, on the other hand, are sympathetic generally. Non-woke COPS are sympathetic to different movements. So our model of watching a large-scale citizen protest in Canada is we expect the COPS to be harsh and the media to be sympathetic. That's the play that they put on. But the thing is, that's based on the assumption that these are going to be left-wing protests. The moment And this is the moment where the opposite happened, where the cops were sympathetic and the journalists weren't, right? Because the cops and the journalists are all, and the mainstream media are almost never on the same side. And cops have, still can retain some significant syndical power. So the other thing is the chief couldn't have commanded a harsh response because of what that would have done to his control over his own force, because they would have looked at him and said, you're a hypocrite. We've just been subjected to a year of hearing about how we're supposed to treat protesters. And now that's only how I'm supposed to treat my enemies. Like when I meet my neighbors at a protest or my friend at a protest or somebody who shares my values at a protest, I'm supposed to treat them like shit. I'm supposed to arrest them. I'm just not supposed to arrest people I have nothing in common with that I'm not socially adjacent to. So I think that, you know, even if this guy had been willing to be a hypocrite, his ability to control, the moment the convoy came into being, it was going to destroy his career through one set of contradictions or another. Its existence was outside of the ideology of the people who had hired him. And they would have found him wanting no matter what he did. Because it wasn't really about his actions at all. It was about them being forced to see the contradictions in their own politics. Now, I mean, I think the whole question of defund the police is fascinating because until 5 minutes ago, progressives believed that austerity could not solve problems. It would only deepen them. That Thatcherite austerity, where you go after a bureaucracy that's failing and you cut its funding, it's like that is not a way to make the bureaucracy stop failing. It will intensify the problems in the bureaucracy. The people at the top will hold on to their money. The people at the bottom will be laid off. The bureaucracy will still be failing. It'll just have fewer frontline personnel now. It's interesting that Thatcherite austerity is what the left is now a consensus. That's how to fix the police, is through a set of policies we've been claiming are totally illegitimate and totally ineffective for 40 years. I actually ran for city council in Surrey in 2018, largely on a massive police reform package from a very left-wing perspective. I called for more shared training among different kinds of first responders and moving training out of the Justice Institute into a school of first response at Kwantlen University, all kinds of stuff. But it's interesting that all of that was viewed as totally legitimate in 2018. And by 2020, the left had abandoned police reform and replaced it with Thatcherite austerity. And I think in part that's because of a consciousness that the police are guild-like. In fact, they're one of the oldest guilds there is. And that guild-like character means that their instinct isn't to make the guild function and be more publicly responsive and do its job better. It's to destroy an enemy guild that isn't part of the consensus. Okay, questions or comments about other stuff? Okay. Well, I think we've managed to get a decent amount thanks for going along for the ride with the secularization thesis idea and how we secularized so hard we didn't secularize at all. I think it's no coincidence that it's quite hard to explain to Canadians how religious the phrase "born in the wrong body" is. It's like, well, what's being born in the wrong body? It's not the brain. The brain is that body. it can only be a pre-existent immortal soul, or if not immortal, at least immaterial. Because what else do you put in a body that represents the true nature of the person if it's not the body itself? It's an immaterial soul. I don't think it's a coincidence that the caring professions in Canada and most liberal Canadians, it takes them a while to even understand that having an immortal soul is not really consistent with the university mandate of methodological atheism, and that it's not consistent even with most religious social contracts, which state that the state has no business governing people's immortal souls. Its business is only in governing their bodies. So this idea of the immaterial soul, you can see what a bedrock assumption it actually is in supposedly secular Canada by people's inability to even grapple with the idea that that might be a religious thing to say, premised on religious ontological dualism. There is a way in which the adoption of social justice as our standard is a profoundly theological one. And the thing is, there was a real process that made us this way. And so I'd urge you to take a look at the Regenerators. I wouldn't read the whole thing. A lot of it is pretty plodding, but it was, I think, a real revolution in Canada's self-awareness and self-understanding. And I don't think it's any coincidence that they have stopped teaching it in graduate school. All right. One more thing, Cheryl.
Yeah, I was just going to mention before, early this morning, I was looking at something and it came out from the Premier of Saskatchewan, and then the Premier of Alberta gets in on it. And I haven't heard anything from the Premier of Manitoba yet, but Scott Moe, I think his name is, was saying something that he'd gotten a letter from Lametti, who's the Justice Minister, saying that the 1930s agreement that was made amongst the Prairie provinces, they might stop it. And I didn't see the reason why by that. My goodness, I thought that was a constitutional thing. And after you were talking when around the convoy just before, I thought, you know, if they really want to get the Prairie provinces really up and other political groups going, go after the farmers, go after the natural resources, because they are, in fact, pitting Central Canada against the Prairie provinces. And the Prairie provinces, I can't see sitting down on this one. I mean, they've just goosed it.
Well, except that they're exploiting a vulnerability. Scott Moe and Danielle Smith are not using proper legal theory. Like, they're autonomous, but they're not autonomists, but they're not like François Legault. François Legault and the Quebec nationalist tradition, including both liberals and conservatives in Quebec, including Duplessis, Lévesque, all of these guys, whenever they sought to protect provincial jurisdiction or seize federal power, they went to the library. They got the best legal scholars. They looked at international law. They looked at Canadian civil law. They looked at law at the common law of England. They looked at adjacent jurisdictions, and they built incredible legal cases. And so the federal government was scared to tear up agreements or go into court, because chances were that the government of Quebec knew its shit better than they did. and had a firm legal leg to stand on. Scott Moe and Daniel Smith, this is an essay that I'll send along. One of my more recent essays is about how Scott Moe and Daniel Smith have nothing to do with that tradition. They just make shit up. They make up crazy shit. Nobody's gone to the library. Nobody spent 5 minutes on Google. They just assert fantasy. They're engaging with questions of federal power from the perspective of fantasists and nullifiers. They are nullifiers. The only legal tradition they're consistent with was the constitutional nullification theory of South Carolina. You want to know how well that went? Andrew Jackson, who was all for local control, found the nullifier theory so bad, he invaded South Carolina, which was one of, like, you know, the strongest pro-Jackson, pro-slavery states. But he's like, no, you can't just tear up the Constitution because you feel like it. You can't just nullify a federal law because you think you can. There is actually some larger legal framework. Even Andrew Jackson, the guy who smashes the power of the judges and the lawyers, goes, no. You've got to justify this. You've got to wrap law around it. And Smith and Moe made a tactical political decision that I think was disastrous. They could have made common cause with Legault and made real constitutional arguments. Smith and Moe refuse to make real constitutional arguments. Their arguments are largely post-political. They want a grievance. They don't actually want those powers. They're like car chasing dogs. They wouldn't even know what to do with those powers. The federal government's like, well, these people aren't going to come into court prepared. These people aren't going to come into a first minister's conference prepared. In fact, they're going to scare other conservatives and the rest of the country onto our side. They're going to scare Legault onto our side. They're going to scare the Tories in PEI onto our side, because they'll realize, like, these people are not in contact with reality. And they actually don't know how to win a fight, a real legal fight over these kinds of questions. So I think that's why they're doing it. I think they see an opportunity because Smith and Moe have taken some very, very bad political advice here. When they became autonomists, I thought, wow, something really interesting could happen here. If they make common cause with Legault, they'll pull Manitoba in, and it will be a real political block that could stop anything at a constitutional conference, that would have this thing tied up in the courts of four different jurisdictions for years. But they're not going to do that. They would rather be beaten up by Trudeau and go, oh, look how mean he is. So I think it's really unfortunate what's happening, because I do think there will be a lot of popular support. But the other thing Trudeau's figured out from his dad, from Jean Chrétien, if it's your third term or later and you're the leader of the Liberal Party of Canada post-1958, you pick a Western province and you run against it. You don't actually run against the Tory leader in Ottawa. You don't run against Pierre Poilievre. You claim Pierre Poilievre is a tool of Danielle Smith and Scott Moe, and you run against them. And Moe and Smith have basically invited him to do that for reasons that are absolutely beyond me. Especially because they've decided the carbon tax is their grievance. Like, that's a great way to get Legault offside. They could have picked any other thing. And Legault would be like, yeah, right, we agree with them. But it's like, I don't want allies who hate carbon taxes and say weird stuff about that. That doesn't play anywhere in Quebec. That doesn't play in the Ile de Madeleine. That doesn't play on the Gaspé. No matter what kind of rural hoser part of Quebec you go to, they still think anthropogenic climate change is real. So yeah, I'm baffled. I'm mystified by this. All right. I'll see you guys very shortly in 2 days, and we'll wrap this thing up.
Thanks, Stuart.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye.